Hey everyone, John Wertheim here. It is this week's Sports Illustrated / Tennis Channel Tennis Podcast. Our guest this week, Jimmy Arias, former top five player, but more recently, a few days ago, he was announced as the new Director of Player Development for IMG Academy. The irony here, such as it is that Jimmy was one of the first IMG pupils in the late 70s, went from his hometown of Buffalo to Florida, and worked with Nick Bollettieri, and that began one of the great concentrations of tennis talent in the sport's history. So now Jimmy is working with IMG. We talked to him a bit about that, a bit about his coaching at the pro level. He got into the mental aspect of tennis a lot more than I anticipated he would, but good conversation with a good guy. Former Grand Slam champion, I will have you know. Trivia, which we can get to at the end. What was Jimmy Arias' Grand Slam title? But for now, we will bring him on from Florida, IMG Academy. Here's Jimmy Arias. How are you?
Hey.
How you doing?
I'm good. A little out of breath.
Man, do I ask why?
I'm hitting with a 10-year-old, and I'm having trouble. It's a bad sign.
We're going to do a podcast while you're hitting with a 10-year-old?
I'm hitting with a 10-year-old, and I'm having trouble. That's the main thing.
I think this
kid's pretty rough.
This is the first podcast we've ever done with a guest on the court.
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
You finished your lesson.
I'm done. You wanna hang on? Let me talk to him for 1 second. Just 1 second.
All right.
I talked a little bit. Our love is at it. Big number one. He has his goal. He has the right kind of goal. Now he's just got to be willing to work, which I think he is. So. He's willing to work, so that's all you can do. Just believe. But all right, good job. Thank you, bud. All right, sorry.
That was great. That was a we got a little glimpse of this is what a coaching pep talk is like. That's great. He's willing to work. I like that kid.
Yeah, exactly. He's actually amazing. I've always thought that I was the best 12-year-old I've ever seen, and. Now I realize that's not the case anymore. Because that kid at 10 would have whooped me, I think.
Is that right?
Yeah, little Canadian kid.
Tell
He's
us.
He's like 2 feet tall and he hits it a million miles an hour.
I was going to ask you about. Well, all right, let's. We're going to talk about you first. Then we can talk about this crazy sport of tennis. But I get an email out of the blue last week saying you have a new position, which sounds very impressive. Tell us what you're going to be doing now.
I am the new Director of Player Development at IMG Academy. It's somewhat interesting because I was sort of the first student.
That's
so
right.
I started the place in some ways. And, you know, that was 1978, not to be dating myself. So quite a few years later, I end up back here again and kind of doing what I love. I mean, they have great coaches. I'm impressed with the program. I'm impressed with the kids. I'm a little surprised because I was expecting them to be a little more spoiled than they are. But they all want to learn. They all want to get better. And nothing more rewarding for me than helping someone that wants to get better. That's sort of it's much fun. And I don't have to do, I'm sort of overseeing. So I don't have a group that I'm in charge of. So that makes it even easier. I can go in and tell them the most important things they need to work on and come back 4 or 5 days later and see if they've gotten better.
So how does that work? You went down there as talented junior. There's this eccentric coach with an Italian last name who's a great motivator and maybe a little less skilled with the X's and O's, but he knows how to wring talent out of young juniors. We're talking about you and Nick, obviously. How does that work now, though? I mean, what's the similarities and differences over the last 40 years?
You mean from this place? Or
yeah,
from,
I mean, is it the same drill with, everyone's got a phone in their pocket, or is this totally different?
It's different. Totally different. When it all started, it was more of Nick was the tennis director at the Colony Beach and Tennis Resort, which was the number one tennis resort in the U.S. anyway. It would get voted by Tennis Magazine all the time. But I didn't know who Nick was, and there was no academy. The guy who owned the Colony was from Buffalo, which is where I'm from originally. So that's how I ended up there on a tennis vacation with a bunch of Buffalo tennis players that used to play with me. And Nick got a look at me and saw that I had a different forehand than what everyone else was hitting in those days. I was 12 and hitting it hard, swinging. So Nick got excited, invited me down, told me he had a school that lets us out at noon, which in those days there was no homeschooling, and I was going to school till 4 o'clock like everyone else. So that was nice. And I got to get away from my crazy tennis parent dad, which was also nice. So I came and I talked to the top 10 kids and top 20 kids in the nation in the 16s. I went to Kalamazoo when I was 13 and talked to those guys. And Paul Anacone was one of them. Okay. But 10 of them at least came. And all of a sudden, Nick had the top juniors, the top American juniors, all in one place. He started getting publicity for it. And, you know, eventually it's turned into what it is now. But when we started, it was more of just, we'd do a couple of drills. We only had a couple courts. So it would be 8 on a court. And you hit 2 balls and run to the end of the line and then run in place for 5 minutes till it's your turn to hit 2 balls. And then at the end of the day, we'd play a little bit. When the guests were done at the Colony, we'd play some sets. So, you know, we were competitive with each other. Now it's unbelievably professional. We still have groups like we did, and you want to get – everybody wants to move up in their to the next group. So there's always that sort of underlying competition. But at the same time, I've never seen – so far I've been here 3 weeks – I've never seen more than 3 people on a court, and a lot of one-on-one. So there's enough coaches to take care of the 200-plus kids. And the other beauty of this is there's always going to be players that are your level, a little better, and a little worse.
Right.
So you sort of get the gamut of practicing with all those different levels.
200 kids
plus
ages.
Now there's the physical side. There's the mental conditioning. They've got everything, the injury prevention and training. And I mean, when I play, I just go on the court, go play.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Not the same sort of level of scientific work to make you the best athlete you could possibly be. And this is cutting edge here.
I always think it's so funny when you go down there and you see, you know, Cam Newton's working out and there are players that are trying to get ready for the combine. And you think this is all what Nick Bollettieri started with, a bunch of ragtag tennis players with their, you know, Prince bags and their thermoses. And now you've got
That's
players
what
from all sports.
It seems impossible. It does seem impossible, I have to say. And the other side of campus, not the tennis side, is a college dorm. I mean, it's unbelievable. It's so nice. Like the everything, all the facilities. I mean, when we were here, when it first started, the food was was rough to deal with, and that's all changed as well. So,
what's the
quite a place.
You said 200 kids. What's the age range on that?
Probably 10 to 18. I mean, there might be a few 8-year-olds even, but it's mostly 10 to 18.
So, of those kids, how much?
Yeah,
I mean, I guess. Sort of what, as we like to say, what's the delta? I mean, how much sort of room for improvement is there? I mean, how much better can you get? How much, like, the kids that are at the top of the ladder as 14-year-olds, what are the odds that they're top of the ladder as 16-year-olds? How much sort of variability is baked into that?
Yeah, I think, I mean, there's quite a bit of variability because sometimes you're great in the 14s, let's say, just because you're big.
Right.
And you're a little stronger,
right.
But your skills aren't quite there, your speed's not quite there, and when people get fast enough. So there's a lot of variables. And the other thing that's difficult for me is when you are great at 12, you sense and feel. I went through this a little bit, so I know the feeling. When you're 12 in the 12-9ers, I was beating everyone 6-1, 6-1, even in the Nationals. So I was killing everybody. But then when those same kids – I always thought I would just kill them all the whole time. Why not?
Right.
But when you're 18, some of them suddenly became 6'3" with 130-mile-an-hour serves, and all of a sudden it's not, I can't beat them 6'1", 6'1" anymore, and you can feel people catching up.
What's that like?
It's not a good feeling. You're feeling that pressure of, I'm supposed to be better than this guy. I mean, I remember my dad, I lost in the pros to Jim Grab. I don't know if you remember Jim Grab.
Yeah, doubles player.
Yes, doubles player. But he got to probably 30 in singles. So I lost to Jim Grab 6-6 in Washington, D.C., and I called my dad, and he goes, he couldn't even carry your shoes in the 12 and unders. He was so mad at me. But that was sort of the pressure I was always feeling of, you know, this is a kid in my age group that couldn't get games off me, and now all of a sudden I'm struggling against him. So that part makes it – that's why you don't see off that often the top 12-year-olds sort of – they're not necessarily the guys that are the top pros.
Tell us – I didn't know anything about this. Tell us more about your dad. You do a good – you do an impersonate. Tell us more about your dad, because I that sort of leads to my next question for you.
About my dad? Well, my dad was basically – He got very involved with my tennis. He didn't know anything about tennis when I was 7 years old. By the time I was 9 years old, he knew everything. And he's the one who taught me the forehand. It was different. I took a lesson from a guy named Ian Fletcher, who had made fourth round of the Australian Open. And he was in Buffalo because he married a Buffalo girl. And he had me with a continental grip, taking the racket straight back, pointing the follow through. And my dad didn't know anything about tennis at that point, but I come off the court. He's from Spain, so he has an accent. I said, Dad, what'd you think? He goes, that's the stupidest thing I ever heard in my life. How can you swing full speed and stop? That means you're slowing the racket down when you're in the hitting zone. Just let it go. So that was sort of the start of, he just wanted me to relax my arm,
right,
and swing as hard as I could, and someday I would be able to control it. Now, the problem was once I started winning, it became not just, I better win, but I better win by certain scores. And you know, he put a lot of pressure from that standpoint. And there's part of me that's very thankful because I think that's the reason I was able to do as well as I did. And I feel like players today, one of the things it created for me was the ability, because I knew I better win and I better win every point, it created the ability in me to be intense with my feet. I needed to be ready and to move. And that's the biggest difference I see with the kids that are going to be good and the kids that are
that's
just going to play college.
Yeah, right.
They all hit the ball nice, but it's this innate intensity with their feet that even when I tell certain kids, you're not there. You're only running as fast as you have to get to the ball rather than getting to the best spot quickly.
Right.
You know, and they it doesn't change. And the good kids are just automatically, their feet are zipping. So that to me is the biggest tell.
That's interesting.
On whether a player's going to make it.
Everyone's got the strokes, but it's all
who's
getting to the ball. That's interesting.
Who's in position to hit those strokes the most often and who's putting themselves in the best spot. That's why this 10-year-old I was just hitting with.
Right.
I mean, it's unbelievable. He looks like a little pro. He's literally 4'1". But his feet are flying, and he's taking the ball early. And like we played 3 points, and he got to net on all three of them and hit drop volleys.
At 4'1".
Yeah.
Nice.
I probably should have lobbed.
He'd beat Jim Grab 6'1", 6'1". I'm not gonna ask you for name because I feel like one of the sins of this sport is saddling these kids with expectation. But the reason I asked about your dad is because when I was that was a few years ago, but when I was at the Academy for a story a few years ago, I was blown away by the parental presence. And what was clear to me was a lot of kids from all over the world, I mean, not just upstate New York, but from, you know, South Korea, they had come as a family. And I left wondering what the impact of that whole family moves to Florida. That, to me, is an interesting dynamic on a kid, and that is a level of pressure that I'm not sure you necessarily get in team sports. How are you dealing with the family dimension to all this?
You're right. It is a difficult situation because a lot of it was a little bit with my dad. It's sort of like the parents are vicariously living through their child's tennis career, and they take the losses and wins even more personally than the player does. And that's an extra level of pressure that the kid doesn't probably need. You know, and you're right. There are a lot of parents around. Back in my day when we started here, there were no parents. I don't know if Nick didn't let them here. Not sure, but no parents showed up. They all just sent their kids. So that part has changed quite a bit. It makes it, you know, a little more intense for the teaching pro too, for the coaches, just
because they've got someone looking
over them all the time, and they're going to complain if they think their kid hasn't played with someone of his level or whatever. So that makes it a little more difficult. But so far, it's been pretty good. I haven't noticed anything.
Are you still, you know, we're supposed to be neutral and objective, but I have to confess, you coach one of my favorite players. Are you still able to coach individual players, or is the WTA player you were working with looking for a new aide de camp right now?
Well, I mean, are you talking about Jessie Pegula?
Yeah, exactly.
Yes. She was always with Jessie Levine, and I was more of a consultant. And I'm not really allowed to work with her unless she comes here, which she might for a little bit of the off season. So she's still going to spend some time with me, and I still talk with her on the phone. But the relationship for now is, I guess, somewhat on hold.
Gotcha.
Unfortunately, because I'm
looking this up. Career high, number 112 right now.
Yeah, I know. And she's going to, if she keeps going the way she's going, she's going to be top 50. So she's on the way. She's moving better. She's doing a lot of things better in the last 6 months. So I hope it continues. She's been a little fragile sort of physically. So that's the part that worries me as far as, you know, if she's injury free, top 50.
Gotcha. When we're done, I'll say why. I mean, are you with me? This is a player to root for. I mean, I was talking to someone about her. We'll just be totally candid. Her father and mother, her parents own the Buffalo Bills, and her father is a fracking magnate, big Penn State hockey player. And I always thought that it really spoke well of her that she would take this individual sport and sleep at the Red Roof Inn at these small events. And I mean, it's brutal playing these challengers, and she could have a much easier life than she does. And she's chosen to compete and see how good she can be at this sport. I find her very admirable.
You are spot on. I got to say, I mean, she brought for me joy back to teaching and helping, because she's somebody, the exact same thoughts I had while I'm working with her. She's working hard. She doesn't have to. She doesn't ever have to work if she doesn't want to. And, you know, she's toiling at 400 in the world when I started.
Right.
And playing, as you said, $15,000 tournaments and with three people watching. That's not glamorous. And she's got amazing character for a billionaire's daughter. Got to give her that. I'm hoping and praying that she continues doing well, because she deserves it.
Top 50. What is this? What is this new position? Can I ask? What does this mean for your extraordinary Tennis Channel work? Can we figure out a way to keep you in the mix?
Well, that's one of the reasons I took the job, is they are happy to have me whenever I get a Tennis Channel gig to take it.
So Oh, good.
That sort of worked out. That was the only way it was going to work, I think. It was a sort of a funny. The first day when I got the invite to come meet with the CFO of IMG, I knew he wanted to maybe talk to me about working here. And I said to him, look, before we get started, this is probably not the best way to go through a job interview, by the way, but I said, let me tell you my philosophy on life. My philosophy is least amount of work, most amount of money. And IMG, from what I've seen over the years, it's kind of the opposite. You work the guys hard, you don't pay them that well. So I have no idea how this is going to work out, but go ahead. What do you got? And it turned out to be just fine. So, and I'm enjoying it.
Yeah, that's an interesting approach to a job interview.
Yeah, you know, like,
when he asked you exactly what your weaknesses were, you know, you're not supposed to say bad hygiene.
I don't want to work.
Exactly.
Yeah, I know. But the truth is, actually, in my defense, is now that I'm here, no one's looking over my shoulder, but I find myself staying here from 8 a.m. I get here at 8 a.m. and I leave at 5. That's a long freaking day for me.
Exactly.
For a guy that's never worked before.
Come on. You were top 5
but
in the
I'm
world.
Enjoying
let's
it.
Work. Let's talk a little tennis in November of 2018. We just kind of sort of finished up our season. We still have Davis Cup left to go. A little bit of a weird year in tennis, wouldn't you say?
No question. I mean, you had certain players like Djokovic and Jack Sock that halfway through the year, I was thinking both these guys are going to be ranked outside the top 100. And I was putting Djokovic in that list because he basically wasn't winning any matches, and he had a boatload of points to defend.
Yeah, right.
After the French, so I was like, I didn't think he'd be outside the top 100, but I thought he's going to be ranked like 40 in the world, and he's going to quit tennis at that point. But I was obviously wrong with Djokovic. Not really as wrong with Sock. He finished outside the top 100, even though he had a nice little move in Paris. Defended reasonably well.
That means
To give him a chance for next year. But it's been an interesting year. I'm surprised at the way Djokovic was able to finish the year after looking so shaky to start.
Really, for me, shaky, right?
When I lost my confidence,
right.
I never really got it back. I played for another 8 years, but it was never the same. I couldn't find that. I'd have glimpses of playing well, but then it would go away again. And that's the part that's amazed me about all three of Djokovic, Nadal, and Federer. At some point in their career, Federer, remember when he was suddenly shanking everything and he was changing rackets?
Yeah, exactly. Shankosaurus.
Couldn't play, really. He was not Roger Federer. And he got it back. And Nadal also has had moments in his career where, you know, he's hitting the ball in the service line slow and high. That doesn't usually work that well. And all of a sudden, he got it back. And now Djokovic has done it as well. So obviously, these greats, these all-time greats, have the ability to recapture the magic.
What do you do in that? I mean, I remember you and I think we talked about this even on the air once. You said, listen, people look at me and they say, oh, he, you know, didn't have the big, powerful serve and he wasn't a 6'5", you know, physical presence. And you said, no, that's what it was. That's not what it was with me. With me, I had a great year, and then my confidence was misplaced. And it was as much about self-belief as it was about hitting the ball or not hitting the ball. What do you do about that?
Well, what do you do? That's the magical question to me. I'm not sure of the answer. I would have tried it. I did try certain things that they teach you. And, you know, I went to Jim Lehrer when I started losing my confidence. And he told me I should do routines. And that after every point, I have to look at my strings and move my strings. And I remember, okay, I'm playing my first match. And I'm looking at my string, moving it, saying to myself, not sure what moving my string's doing for my forehand. My forehand's still going out. like that didn't work for me.
Right.
So, you know, the confidence thing to me is something that comes from winning. And once you stop winning, it's hard to find that confidence again. But I guess these guys are they're a level better than everybody else. The three guys I mentioned.
Yeah.
So at some point they're going to win again. Because they're better, and once they've won four or five matches, then they feel like they're back, I guess. You know, and I was never that much better than everyone. So once I lost the confidence, I didn't really get the wins like I had before.
I just, you know, you see this unfolding. I think it's one of the rare sports where, you know, there's nowhere to hide. It's not like you can pass up that jumper and you don't really. I mean, it's you're out there and you're either hitting that forehand or you're not. You're either winning or you're losing. You see this unfolding with other players. You know, you mentioned Jack Sock, and you can just see the way he's playing at four all, the forehands he's missing late in the set that he was making earlier in the set. It's one of the enduring mysteries of this sport.
It just shows you how important that aspect of the game, the mental side of the game, is. And people don't recognize it. On the pro level, everyone hits the ball great, especially now. At least in my era, people had weaknesses you could try to get to.
Right.
Today's guys, you don't see any obvious weaknesses other than they might miss a few more. So it comes down to who believes in those big moments. And I can just, from experience, the first 10 tie breaks in the final set that I played, I was 10-0. And I thought I was going to win every time. Like, I would go into the tiebreak not nervous because I knew the end result is I'm going to win. And then I lost 10 in a row after that when I lost my confidence. Just to give you an idea. So it's all with Sock, you're right. He's just losing the big points. He still looks so dangerous. He's such a great athlete. I mean, it's amazing watching him play.
Right.
But he seems to fall apart this year, at least, at the big moments in matches. And can he get that back? I think he might be. He needs to work harder. He's been hanging around too much with Nick Kyrgios, in my mind.
So socially, yeah. No, I mean, that's what the other thing you hear about him.
I think
him
if he works hard, then he'll maybe, because he's put in the effort on practice and training, he'll fight to the end a little bit better. Just, you know, it's easier when you haven't been working hard to give it up, I think. But he's going to have to turn that around this year. He's not going to have much pressure. He doesn't have any points to defend.
The points have fallen off, you know, it's like dandruff on an old man. I mean, those points have drifted off already. But the other thing, too, is he can't go too much further. He's going to be playing qualifying. I mean,
does he become a double specialist? Because he's going to try to go make the money playing the Masters 1000s, but he can't get in any of them.
Right.
So he's just going to be doubles. I mean, that's the danger of that. I don't know if he's going to. I think he'll probably not concentrate on doubles and go ahead and keep trying in singles.
He needs a new doubles partner too. As long as you brought, so I mean, take us in there. Obviously, it's going to be different player to player, but it's your confidence is fractured. You're one of these players who doesn't have the self belief that he once did, and it's four all on the breaker. What is the conversation with yourself like? I mean, what is it? Is it fear? Yeah. Is it dread? Is it self-loathing? I mean, what are you telling yourself when you don't have confidence that is different than when you do?
It's fear. It's the sort of the doubt of, I remember, like I told you, first 10 tiebreak in the thirds, I knew I was going to win, so nothing bothered me. When I lost that confidence, if I got a bad call, or if what I thought was a bad call or a bad bounce or anything like that, I would start telling myself, see, this is why you're not winning, though. You can't get any luck, blah, blah, blah. Like, you start looking at outside things to sort of take away the pressure, but you're looking for excuses on why you lost. And once you start searching for a reason why you lost before the match is over, you've lost.
Yeah, exactly.
You might as well shake hands.
Exactly.
So, and that at least was what was happening to me. I'd start looking for an excuse to tell my dad I lost because. And as soon as I did that in a match, that was it.
Right.
I should have just walked up and shook hands with the guy.
Did you watch any of the matches from London?
The ATP? Not too many, actually.
I mean, I just couldn't get over the. So it's indoor surface and it's only eight guys and there. But to me, what really set it apart from a conventional event was this round robin format. And you forget this whole business in tennis of one loss and you're out of the tournament. You know, it's not like you shoot a bad round on Thursday and you can make it up on Friday, or it's not like you're in the NBA and you got 82 games. Seeing this round robin format and realizing how different that is from, you know, win or go home.
Yeah.
It's a rough business, man.
It changes everything. It's fun at the end.
Yeah, exactly.
It's fun at the end because it's coming down to sets and games and all that sort of stuff. By the way, I didn't see it, but how did Kei Nishikori lose 0-1?
After beating Federer.
I did not see that match.
You know, it's funny. I was following that match on my phone, and I thought, oh, he must be hurt, and he just doesn't want to retire, and he's playing it out.
Yeah.
That didn't seem to be the case. From what I heard, the guy just couldn't hit the ball in the court. And that came 48 hours after beating Federer. So
that's amazing. Yeah,
IMG
that's
zone.
Amazing.
All right, 2019 speed round, real quick. How many majors does Djokovic win? The guy who you thought was going to be outside the top 100 90 days ago, that guy Djokovic. How many majors does he win next year?
Next year?
Yeah,
he wins. He wins two.
Who wins the other two?
I'm giving him two. You can't go against Nadal at the French.
Right.
And I don't know. I think somebody will come up with something. And I don't know who the answer is. It could be Zverev if he finally learns how to play under pressure, meaning I've seen him get tight at different times, and he seems to get tight in the majors. But he certainly has the game, as he showed in London. to make that breakthrough. Some of those young up and coming guns, who knows? Hatchinoff, Tsitsipas, you know, I think one of them might have their moment in the sun. Probably at the U.S. Open.
You think? Really?
Yeah. Well, because I think the French is, you know.
French is Nadal. Yeah, kind of, right. Write that
off.
Yeah,
it feels like it's Nadal and Dominic Thiem.
Right.
And Wimbledon, at least the way last year went, it feels like that's Djokovic. Or Federer, maybe a Federer, you know, gets hot for those 2 weeks. But the U.S. Open, it's the end of the year. The guys are a little tired. I could see someone making a breakthrough. Australia as well, because it's the first slam of the year and it's hot and, you know, anything can happen.
Yeah, I always feel like Australia, in the end, these veterans, you know, and in the big three, they just, A, they're better at the off season. I mean, Federer is a master at starting strong and having
a real
training camp. And I also just think, especially at the beginning of the year when you haven't had any before and you haven't paced yourself, this best of five is really tough for younger players.
Yeah, in the heat. Yeah,
in the heat. Yeah, exactly. In the heat. It's some, you know, it's 105 degrees on a middle Saturday, and it takes some experience to know how to ration your energy. What about women's side? Serena Williams does what in 2019?
Oh man, that's tough. I mean, I still feel like she's the player to beat whenever she shows up. Which I guess you could say the same about Djokovic, the way he ended the year. So maybe I'll just give her two slams as well.
All right, that would put her over the top. That would be a new record. So someone I suspect you will see in Bradenton. What do we expect from Naomi Osaka?
Of Naomi Osaka?
Yeah,
I think she. See, the problem is when I've seen her play, the only two times I've seen her play, she was amazing. Indian Wells and the U.S. Open. I mean,
good samples.
Those are the main two times that I watched her.
Right.
And I'm thinking she's Serena Williams, except younger now, the way she plays. She hits the ball huge, hits big second serve, moves really well, you know, and hits big, is overpowering, is intimidating. So that Naomi Osaka could be the next number one in my mind, but I don't know what happens the other.
I was going to say, if you're basing it on those two tournaments, absolutely.
Yeah. So it's hard. Yeah, it's hard for me to because I didn't see her play the tournament. She wasn't doing well, and I don't know what happens when she loses. Did she just start missing? That's what
she
I would
can't
seem
hit
to
the
me,
ball
like,
well, and there's some sort of crisis of confidence moments too. But no, I mean, I think I think it's a really good sign that she played pretty well after the U.S. Open. Wasn't like she.
Yeah, me too.
But are you going to have much interaction with the pros? Yeah, I mean, you mentioned Nishikori, Osaka. I mean, there are a number of players who I suspect are going to be on the court next to you pretty soon.
Yes. No, I will have some interaction with the pros as well. But most of the pros come with their coaches. So, you know, I'll be out there a little bit with them. But I don't want to step on anybody's toes. And that's sort of. Even within the program, a lot of the times I go to the coach, the group leader first, when I see something with a kid that I think this needs to be changed.
Right.
I don't go to the kid. I go to the coach and we talk it over and he'll tell me where this kid's come from. Maybe that's too advanced for where he is right now. You know, I leave it up to the coach a little bit, and that's the same thing I would do with the pros.
That's good management right there. So, last question. What is the ideal number of team cups in men's tennis? 0, 1, 2, or 3?
I mean, it's a hard answer because I would say 1, except I thought the Laver Cup was the coolest thing I'd ever seen.
Yeah, right.
So,
right.
And you know, and I obviously the Davis Cup because when I was a kid growing up, the Davis Cup was basically as big as any major. You know, that's the one thing you definitely saw on TV was the Davis Cup tie. And so I have a special place sort of in my heart for Davis Cup, but it has lost a little of its luster over the years. And like I said, I love the Laver Cup. It was so much fun watching the guys in what is essentially an exhibition be so into it that they're getting nervous. They're getting tight. It was great to see.
That
and
was,
the atmosphere was amazing.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think everyone says atmosphere is amazing, and you over if you were there and you said, my gosh, it's a Tuesday afternoon, and these fans are going crazy.
Crazy, yeah. It was the best. It was. I've never had the chills more often from crowd noise than I did at the Laver Cup. However, when the 18,000 or whatever was there, they were making a lot of noise.
What you're saying
and
too,
the matches sort of lived up to it. So.
The matches were great. The teams, you know, but I also said it's with an indoor event. It's not like half the crowd is. You know, sometimes you see these events and the main stadium is, you know, 30% full because the fans are strolling the grounds and they're in the food court. They're looking at matches on the ground. You know, they're watching doubles. There was only one match. So if you have an indoor venue, when the match starts, that's where the action is. It's not as though half the fans are out on the plaza.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, this was great. We've hit our we hit our half hour. Go. There's a 10-year-old on the court next to you who needs your wisdom. Don't let us keep you from generating the next generation. But this was great. Always a pleasure.
Awesome. Thanks, John.
All right, thanks, Jimmy. Take care.
Take care. We'll see ya.
Take care. All right, thanks to Jimmy, one of the sports good guys. Congratulations on his new gig at the IMG Academy. The answer to that question, by the way, French Open mixed doubles 1981, partnered with Andrea Jaeger. That was Jimmy Arias' Grand Slam title. Jamie Lasanti, our trusty producer, bring you in. You listen
Welcome
to that
back.
Conversation. Thanks. It's been an interesting week. Nice to be back. Not as jet-lagged as I thought I would be. Good conversation with Jimmy Arias. What struck you?
Yeah, I thought it was interesting how he was talking about the difference between, you know, when he was there versus now he's on the other side coaching. And he was talking a little bit about kind of not having the same scientific level of training and just everything they do to prepare for the game and to get better. It was, you know, kind of some of the stuff was new to him. And I was kind of curious, you know, I wonder if he... if that changes how he coaches, you know, does he kind of coach based on how he was coached when he was younger, when all these things didn't exist, or has he adapted things from the new methods and ways of training since he's been there? So,
don't you think that's something all coaches work with? I would even go further. You could even expand that to sort of anyone in a position of authority, that at some level we're all products of our experiences. You know what worked and what didn't work, but you also want to innovate at the same time. It's an interesting kind of push-pull, especially for someone, you know, I don't know what Jimmy, probably early 50s. It's interesting, interesting tension there. It's funny, too, because he's not a big guy. I don't know if you know him. I mean, he got to number 5 in the world. Boy, I don't know. He must have been 19, 20. I mean, a young kid. He must have been 19, 20 years old. He got to number 5 in the world. French Open quarterfinalist, I believe. And then he sort of stopped progressing. And I always had assumed it was just, not a big guy, didn't have the weapons, scrappy player, maybe his body gave out. I didn't realize the extent to which it was confidence-based. Interesting to hear him talk so candidly about that.
Yeah, I love the thing about playing with the racket and kind of developing a ritual. I feel like I read a lot about people trying to tell you, whether it's in sport or in life, on how to kind of maximize your potential and, you know, live to the fullest and all this stuff. And some of it is, I think, very good and it really does help. And some of it, I kind of do the same thing as he did, standing there, you know, fiddling with his strings, like, what the hell is this going to do for me? And, you know, maybe this one isn't really for me. So I thought that was fun and interesting.
The power of habit.
Yes.
No, I mean, I think Nadal is always an interesting case study in that, too.
Yeah.
Maybe takes it to a certain extreme. But people ask him about it, and he sort of says, these rituals are important to me. These habits are important to me. You want to talk about the sort of topic du jour in tennis these days?
Surely.
I don't know. I mean, at least in my silo. And I think this is one of the issues of this social media age. This is a larger topic, but I don't know if you have this as well. You have a hard time figuring out what's important objectively, and is it only in my little silo world where it's tennis, it's media, it's some TV stuff, and then I talk about it with my wife, and she said, "Oh, I've never even heard about that."
Right. Well, we create our own little
circles
here. So,
Sheryl Sandberg. I mean, I think there's a really broader point to be made here. I think it makes it very hard. We talk about connections of social media, but I think there also is this element of detachment where you're in your own island and something that you and I are debating back and forth with, and there are a million Twitter battles, and then you talk to the person next to you, and they've never even heard of it.
No idea.
Not just me.
Well, in your circle.
In my circle, this issue of Julian Beneteau, Roger Federer, preferential treatment, Tennis Australia. Again, I'm open to certainly the suggestion and the possibility that not as big a deal as it seems to be in my world, but this did seem to trigger quite a bit of chatter. And, you know, Roger Federer was asked about it multiple times in London. This obviously, and you can look this up, there was a radio interview and then a summation of that interview where Julian Beneteau, who just recently retired, who I don't know if this is irony or if this stands to reason, but this is someone who knew Roger Federer for 20 years, you know, when they were teenagers playing in the juniors. So these two know each other quite well. And the assertion was essentially that if rules aren't broken, they are sure bent to accommodate Roger Federer. And he benefits from, I guess we'll crassly call it preferential treatment. But I think it was an interesting sort of glimpse into some of tennis's darker arts.
Yeah, I agree. I thought, you know, I kind of agree with you on when there's financial payment involved, if we're talking about that side of things, that preferential treatment, that may not be so good. But in terms of scheduling, I think it brings up kind of an interesting thing with tennis because it is very unique where, you know, you're not having 6 NFL games in one day, you know, or you don't have to schedule these things in a stacked way where you're trying to get most people to come in and watch and most people to watch on TV. And so on the one side, you know, they do move games for primetime reasons, right? Primetime exists for a reason. Right. And so I think on one side of the coin, you have that where it's like, all right, we want to put Roger Federer on primetime. So that's the reason why he's always playing on, you know, at night at the US Open or whatever the case may be. I get that. The other thing is that I do believe that if Federer were to say, I want to play during the day, which I think he did in a recent tournament where it was, I don't recall exactly.
Yeah, he's said that before. The US Open, sometimes it's a kid's thing.
Right, he sort of made a request. Right. And it's more often than not honored. And I think that's when it gets a little weird. I think for people outside of tennis, they would say for sure that is favoritism. And, you know, why can't somebody else get that treatment? But
yeah, if you're the tournament director and you're getting a lot of money from TV, they're paying a lot of money to air your matches. And you say, oh, it's a night match. And they say, we want Federer. And you say, no, I've got to give you Philip Kohlschreiber. Well, why do you have to do that? Well, Rogers played too many
night
matches.
That's what I said. I think there's a difference between prime time and you're talking about ticket sales and viewership and ratings and all that stuff, which brings in, and honestly, that brings in the money conversation. But when you're talking about a random match in the middle of the day or court placement or something like that, I think there are some bending of the rules in tennis that happens to top players that maybe a younger, lesser known player may not get the same benefits, but you know, maybe is that just the benefit of someone who's been around longer? I mean, that happens in a regular workplace, you know, there are people who have been at companies for years and they surely get more benefits and have things that I don't or other
Jamie.
People don't. No, I don't mean that in
You're
a bad way, but
well
that's
regarded here.
That's how things work. I feel like that's sort of just the way of life. So,
Yeah, I see it both sides.
It's debatable.
I mean, I think this issue of, listen, it's hot as Hades out here, and this guy gets to play every single match in 72 degrees at night. I get that, but I also see it from the tournament's perspective, which is, what are we supposed to do? It's not like we're giving him the you know, it's not like we're creating a special session. Someone's got to play at night. Why wouldn't we give the session to the guy who everybody wants to watch play? I think what got a little bit lost in that story, and I think Tennis Australia deserves, In some ways, they deserve some credit for pushing the envelope and enterprising, and they really have tried to move beyond just being a federation or a group that runs a tournament for 2 weeks a year. They've really tried to branch into media and production, but boy, some of those ties are awfully cozy, and I suspect if sort of the emoluments department, if you ran that by the guys in the compliance group, that might not pass conflict of interest muster. But
Craig Tiley responded kind of to this a little bit.
Yeah.
But his response was very blanketed as sort of like kind of blaming the or pointing to marketing and primetime and TV and kind of also saying, well, we listen to our players because of, you know, we ask them what food they want and where they want to park and what they want to do when they come to our tournament. And, you know, they get treatment in that sort of way. And I didn't know if
Should Tennis Australia, and I would say the same thing to the USTA, should they be involved in a private for-profit event put on by a player?
No, that's what I was saying. I mean, that's where things got a little bit
God
sticky.
Bless you for serving sushi, but I don't think that's the that's the issue here. Tennis.
It really is unlike anything.
It's like unlike. I mean, the point I always make is if they were going to start this sport tomorrow, we're going to come up with a business model that really optimizes value and that really traffics in fairness and that really stands clear of any antitrust. It would look nothing like the product you have out there right now.
How would you? So if, you know, if players weren't able, they created a rule. Players are not able to request certain schedules, certain courts. I want to play at night. Sorry, we're not accepting requests for when you want to play. How would you organize
to me that's sort
created.
Of a small sliver of the greater conflicts of interest and sort of the
of course
structural flaws of tennis. But I think with that, it's very simple. You just put a cap on it, right? And sort of we get it. We get that there are some commercial demands here. We get that there's something transactional about this. We understand the fans want to see Roger Federer. They don't want to see him buried at court 17 at Tuesday at 2 o'clock. But at a Grand Slam, the maximum number of night sessions you get is 4. And you have to play a secondary court at least once, which I think, you know, the French Open does that. Some tournaments are better than others. I think the way you'd handle that
is just
put a cap. Look, we're not going to draw out of a hat. We're not going to have the night session be 2 qualifiers. Nobody knows. But the flip side is when, especially in a tournament like the Australian Open, when conditions, temperature, heat, durability, those are such issues, it does seem a little strange to have one player play 6 of the 7 matches.
It is. It's just the problem is that everything is so subjective. The conditions are subjective. When people want to play is subjective. Some players may excel at night. Some players may want to play during the day. You know, the deciding on what matches get played on what courts is subjective. I mean, we sit at majors and we wait for the schedule to come out the next day. We know who's playing, but the schedule and where you have to go, somebody else, like some overlord, is creating that. And so that's
all of that stuff
is subjective, and it just kind of, you know, what are they thinking about when they're deciding who gets to play on court 17 and who plays on, you know.
Hey, I flew into town from Europe and I wanted to watch Steph Curry and the Warriors play because I love Steph Curry. Well, what time's the game? I don't know. It depends what time the Orlando Magic finish, and then after that, maybe the San Antonio Spurs will go long, so we're not sure. Well, is he playing on Tuesday or Wednesday? Yeah, I don't know. It depends when the tournament gives him a start. Oh, no, if he loses, he's out and he's on a jet home. Tennis asks a lot of its fans. I would put it that way. But yeah, the lack of a concrete start time or finishing time for that matter. Hey, how long is this match going to be? Well, it could be 90 minutes and it could be 5 hours. We're not sure.
So you're on your third banana waiting for the waiting for your match to start.
That's why we love this sport. other topics. We have a Davis Cup coming up, which I think sentimentally is the last Davis Cup in this current format. France and Croatia. We have the women's game is in the freezer for. I credit women's tennis. They got this thing over and done with. They get a full 8 weeks of an off season. I did think that Sasha Zverev complaining about the length of the season, which I think he was completely entitled to do, and I think Kafelnikov was way off base taking issue with that. But Zverev complaining about the length of the season, but then finishing stronger than anyone and beating Federer and Nadal.
I'll show you guys.
Yeah, exactly. You think you're gonna chase me off? Good weekend for Sasha Zverev. I do wonder, and I think it's an open question. We'll have to see. There will be an answer to this. But to what extent is this predictive? I mean, it's a great title for him. Beating Roger Federer and Novak Djokovic, especially on that court, is no small feat. I'm not quite sure how that translates to best of 5 matches in Australia on the other side of the world.
The biggest question is just how does that translate to a major? I mean, that's his one. He did a little bit better towards the end of the season, so hopefully for 2019 we'll see it.
I'd also say to his credit, I think he knows deep down that this has been disappointing.
Right.
I mean,
right.
I think
he's not
outwitted. You know, I don't think
he's
trying to
fighting
sort of,
back
exactly,
and saying exactly. like, "Well, I've done this." He's been very accepting, and you feel like he at least understands what he has to do to get there. He may not be on the fast track there, but he gets it, I think.
Can I make one of my tennis UFC comparisons?
Sure.
So in UFC, in cage fighting, you have these young fighters come out, and sometimes they're terrific, and they sort of fight with sort of devil-may-care abandon, and they don't care, and they haven't been hit much, and they just come out, the bell rings, the air horn goes off, and they just start wailing away. The trouble is that when they get into tougher fights, they're not quite sure how to pace themselves, and it's a new set. The neurochemistry changes. They're not quite sure how much to hold back, how much they need to have in the tank. It really benefits veteran fighters to have that experience and to know 10 minutes into this thing how much gas I need to have and how much to push and how much to hold back. I think best of five tennis has a lot of that same element. And if you know that the match is only going to be 90 minutes long, especially indoors, it's very easy just to sort of to go all out and play your hardest. When you're out there and you're saying, boy, I need to prepare myself here. I need to be resigned and realistic. This could be a 3.5-hour match in the heat. I think that's something that really benefits a Djokovic, a Federer, Nadal, who have had these battles. They know there are going to be some lulls in the match. They know how to leave some gas in the tank. And I worry with taking this back to Zverev, I just think there's a huge difference that we don't always appreciate between best of three and best of five. All right, this was a long podcast. I'm looking at the time here. We should wrap this up. We should wish everyone a happy Thanksgiving. We are going to do a few more of these before the end of the year. We may have a standard standby guest who's been on this show quite a few times. We may have a new guest. We did have a request to talk about the new ITF Tour, which is replacing the sort of format in tennis, which is a big move in the sport. For players sort of ranked 100 and below. We'll be talking about that. But that will do it for today. Thanks, Jamie, as always. Appreciate that.
Thank you. Good to have you back here in the studio.
Oh, thanks. We'll try to stick around a while. Thanks to Jimmy Arias, great guest, and thanks to you all for listening. We'll do it again in a week. If people were so inclined to either order up this podcast or leave a review, where might they go?
They can go on Apple Podcasts or wherever they go and order their podcast. Yeah.
Very good. All right. Thanks, everyone. Thanks for listening. We'll do it again in a week. Take care.